Hello there, and welcome to another edition of the Marlena program. This is the program for the week of April 14th. Whoa, where is spring going? We've got a great show for you tonight, so come on in, sit down, relax, and enjoy. Well, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world. I'm Marlena, and very much looking forward to the program tonight, because very selfishly, I get to spend some time with a good friend and someone I've known for quite some time. But before we get into all of that, let's do the housekeeping that we need to do. If you're listening to this program at any time between the hours of 9 and 11 in the East, 6 and 8 in the West, on a North American Sunday night, then you've got it live, and we're glad you're here. If you're listening between 1 to 2, or 1 to 3, rather, UTC on an early Monday morning, what the heck are you doing up? But we're glad you're here as well. If you're listening at any other time, such as to a podcast or a replay, then it's not live, so just put your feet up and enjoy the program. I am very delighted that it's springtime, baseball's back, and boy, I tell you, the weather in Seattle yesterday, I stress, yesterday was fabulous. Today, that wasn't the word I'd use for it. But we're not here to talk about the weather in Seattle tonight. We are here to meet someone whom I think you will find fascinating, who certainly captured the attention and the spirit and the attention and spirit and participation is the word I'm looking for, of our participants at the ACB Legislative Seminar. And you've heard his name in the news. He is a psychologist. He's an ordained rabbi. And he's my friend, Dennis Solomon. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the Marlena program.
Hi, Marlena. It's great to be with you.
Oh, my goodness. We have a bit of an echo here, but it'll fix itself. The more you talk, the more it'll fix itself.
Okay.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I know so many people have been looking forward to your coming on the show, so I welcome you, and I'm just delighted that you're able to be here. I want to talk.
I want to say I'm so pleased that you're giving me a national or international mouthpiece. It's wonderful to be able to talk with you again, and also to talk to your listeners all over the world.
Well, that's great. I just think that, I mean, you're just a very cool person to begin with, but, you know, to have you doing what you're doing is something that I truly want to highlight in this program.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to kind of go back a bit. We all know that you're running for Congress in the 5th District in New Jersey. At least anyone who read my show announcement where I sent it everywhere. And then my mailer, Dennis, got on your side today and it sent it about 6 times.
Oh, really?
To many, many people. So even my mailer, you see, is supporting your candidacy here. But I want to go back a bit and talk to us about you. Now, were you born blind?
No. I was born and raised in Worcester, Massachusetts, and lost my vision gradually throughout my childhood, so that by the time I was in fifth and sixth grade, I had no vision in my left eye.
Mm-hmm.
But I had enough vision in my right eye that I could read regular print,
mm-hmm.
ink print. By the time I was in seventh grade, I was reading large print.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was in eighth or ninth grade, I was reading Braille. Didn't have to carry a cane until I was 16. Probably should have carried a cane when I was 14. And by the time I went to college, I was totally blind.
I see. So when I met you back in 68, Total blindness was almost a new thing for you, eh?
No, although, as I said, I was adjusting to it gradually over those years, so that, you know, I was not able to, my youthful vision had been pretty much gone for about a year or two by the time we met in that summer between high school and college.
And growing up, you worked in a toy factory? What's that all about?
I grew up in a poor family, a family that was financially strapped. And so the minute I could get my working permit in Worcester, Massachusetts, I started working after school, you know, taking the bus to the toy factory. It was a toy factory, and continued doing that through the summer months. It was a toy factory that actually hired. It was easy to get a job as a high school kid who was disabled. They tended to hire a lot of disabled people. They didn't treat them all that wonderfully, but it was a place I could actually make minimum wage, and that was helpful to my family. I mean, that's not the only job I had in high school. As you know, I was very musical.
Yeah, I know.
Still am. I mean, I played the drums and guitar and all that. When I was 16, one of the things I did to support my family was every Saturday night I used to play drums in a strip club in, outside of Worcester.
And, this I didn't know, Dennis.
This is ironic because here you have a blind adolescent playing drums in a strip club. It probably was the first time I said to myself, oh, please, give me back my vision. But I actually made good money. In 1966, I was making like $25 every Saturday night playing drums in this club.
Oh, that is hysterical. That's very funny. So then you went on to Brandeis.
Yeah, and Brandeis.
And you met Pam at Brandeis.
I met my girlfriend, who became my wife for 34 years.
That's now. Amazing. Wow.
And we were both, we met both in the sophomore year. Actually, we were both, the way we met was we were both volunteering to work at the Fernald School for mentally retarded folks. At the time, it was called the Fernald School for, I forgot what the institution for the mentally retarded.
Yeah.
And it was a very large state institution, and we actually worked together in what they called the Green Blind Unit, which was a unit for multiply handicapped children and adults.
Wow, that's fascinating. You bring up the Fernald School, and I haven't thought of that in years.
Yes,
And so then you eventually received your PhD in psychology, and
right after Brandeis, I graduated in 72 with a BA actually in sociology, and then I went on to the program at Harvard in clinical psychology and public practice, and finished there in 1976.
How important to you was Braille all through your schooling?
Oh, hugely. I mean, one of the things that I'm very troubled by is it seems, because there's been so many alternatives, that many people that I meet who are younger people who are blind or visually impaired have not really learned Braille. And for me, in my schooling, it was extremely important. But it also, in my career, it's been extremely important because one needs to have a way to refer to notes when one is giving a lecture or giving a sermon or speaking in a campaign situation. And there really, I mean, for me, there was no alternative to Braille. I mean, I've never been able to listen to my notes while I speak. Maybe some people can master that, but I think Braille is just remarkable for that. And also, of course, if one wants to do careful study of a text, whatever the text may be, you know, Braille is much more helpful to that process than, let's say, listening to something on tape.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I tend to use Braille for more of my factual, technical reading.
Right.
And
right.
For my pleasure reading, I tend to use audio because my
oh,
mind
sure.
can drift and, you know, it just, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, I think as a handicapped person, as a visually impaired person, as a blind person, we have to use all of the resources that are available to us. And of course, there are many more today, Marlena, of course, for all of us, than there was in 1968 when we all went to, when you and I went to college. And, but, I mean, so of course, I think it's remarkable the advances that have been made. So, I mean, the way I do my work today is very different than the way I did with my work in 1968. But I think that all of it should be mastered by people who need these kind of new resources, you know, computer access, Braille, listening, learning to listen at a very fast rate, especially if you're in college or graduate school, extremely important to get through a lot of material in a short period of time. I mean, mastering it all, I think, is really important.
And then what led you to become an ordained rabbi?
Well, it's an interesting story. I about 15 years ago or so, I was only ordained 5 years ago. I'm 57, about to be 58. And about 5 years ago, I was ordained. But about 15 years ago or so, I became very interested in, I've always given a lot of lectures as a psychologist to psychoanalytic institutes throughout the country. And I became very interested in understanding the psychological perspective on certain stories in the Bible. That became a focus of my lectures. This is 15 years ago. And I became more and more involved in understanding some of these biblical stories. And it really was through that, the study of it, thinking that I was studying it as a psychologist. and my friends all knew I was becoming a rabbi before I knew it, you know, because I got more and more involved. And one thing led to another, and those lectures on the psychological perspective on the Bible actually resulted, became my rabbinic dissertation, ultimately, a book that was published called The Genius of Genesis. But it was really through my study as a psychologist that I approached it, and now I was ordained, as I said, 5 years ago, and it's been a wonderful combination of having a psychotherapy practice, teaching and supervising as a psychotherapist, setting up a international program devoted to psychoanalytic training, but also teaching and being a practicing rabbi with a pulpit.
Is your book available in alternative formats?
Yes. I know it's available on Bookshare, and I believe, I have a copy in Braille and in tape from the Jewish Braille Institute, JBI. I don't know, to be honest, I haven't checked recently if the Recordings for the Blind had done it. They had been talking about doing it. But I know it's available on Bookshare and at JBI.
Very cool. Very, very cool. All right. So let's move on. What on earth led you to run for Congress?
Outrage. I mean, that's really the only answer.
Outrage.
Outrage. Outrage. I have been outraged at the direction that this country has been taking for the last 7 years. The person who is the congressional representative in this district, which includes much of Bergen County in New Jersey, people probably have heard of Tenafly and Paramus and Bergenfield and Ridgewood, those towns in Bergen County and other parts of this of northern New Jersey, includes actually pieces of four counties here, this district. The person who's represented this district is the most conservative representative in the United States House of Representatives, according to the American Conservative Union. He's been voted 100% career record, and he just does not match this district at all. Some of his votes are so outrageous, and they outrage me that he is our representative. He, of course, has been terrible on issues relating to disabilities. We can talk specifically about those, but just the key issue that most recently came up is he has voted and spoken against supporting the hate crime legislation that recently came up and never actually went through, that included disability people among the hate crimes. He voted against the aid for Katrina victims generally, but also the bill that would have make certain allowances for future natural disasters that made accommodations for disabled people.
Wait, you're saying he voted against
he
aid
voted against
for
all
Katrina
bills
victims?
Involving aid for Katrina. He voted against all bills involving Head Start. He's voted against, of course, Choice for Women. He's voted against stem cell research, any funding of stem cell research. He was the only northern legislator. I'm talking about only northern legislator, Democrat or Republican, to vote against the Voting Rights Reauthorization Act that just came up that assured, of course it went through, but he was the only northern legislator to vote against this bill that basically assures all people a right to vote in this country. That was won in 1965. He's voted, he is very much disliked by anyone who are animal lovers. And so I ask all your listeners to cover the ears of their seeing eye dogs.
Oh, dear.
Because he voted, he was one of a few who actually voted for allowing interstate trafficking of dog fighting.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding you. You can look this all up. This is not just political rhetoric. For someone to be the most conservative representative in the United States House of Representatives and to represent a part of the northeastern United States is already outrageous. Now, when I've been outraged for 7 years, and people knew that. I mean, I was not totally quiet about that. As you know, Marlene, I'm not someone who keeps my feelings to myself often.
Yes.
And people said that what is required in this district, because what the reason why he is the incumbent here is because he keeps a very low profile and he gets away with it. He can keep a low profile because we are in a bedroom community. Most of the district is a, you know, bedroom community for New York City.
Mm-hmm.
New York City media is extremely expensive. We don't have any TV or radio of our own.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of wasted ears and wasted eyes on the TV and radio here in this area. And so someone, in order to make a good run, one has to either have free media attention. I shouldn't say either or. One has to have free media attention, has to have a lot of generated interest in the district, and a lot of money to get the message out. And people said to me, look, I have an interesting story. I do. it's an unusual candidate story, not unlike Stephen Novick, who I just heard wonderfully on your same radio station a few minutes ago. I have an interesting story. There's been a lot of media attention. And, of course, there's been a lot of attention of the psychological community throughout the country, the disability community throughout this country, the Jewish community throughout this country. I mean, we've had a lot of support from lots of different communities and, of course, the progressive community throughout this country. And for that reason, for the first time in a bunch of years, the Democratic Congressional Committee has actually targeted this seat as a winnable seat. And so it looks like there's going to be a real run, and this is going to be a good year for Democrats. I think this is going to be a good year for this district, and so I'm looking forward to being the first congressman who is blind in Congress in 70 years.
That is just an incredible story. We're going to be right back, and I'd like to talk about how your blindness, or whether your blindness, creates any interesting challenges for you as you run for this seat. I'm Marlena, and tonight we're talking with Dennis Shulman. Dennis is running for Congress in the 5th District in New Jersey. He is an ordained rabbi, he is a psychologist, and he is a very longtime friend of mine. We'll be right back, and we will open the lines when we return right here on the Marlena program. This program is brought to you by HumanWare, advocates for Braille literacy and manufacturers of the Braille Note M-Power. For more information on the Braille Note and other fine HumanWare products, visit them on the web at www.humanware.com or call HumanWare at 1-800-722-3393.
ACB Radio is brought to you by the American Council of the Blind. If you would like more information about the council, visit their website at www.acb.org. That's www.acb.org. ACB, the people that bring you ACB Radio.
You're listening to ACB Radio Mainstream. Call Marlena now at 1-866-666-7926. That's toll-free, 1-866-666-7926.
All righty, and Gary, the board guy, informs me that the line is open, so we're waiting for your calls. Does blindness, Dennis, create any kind of interesting challenges for you as you run for this seat in the 5th District in New Jersey?
It's wonderful. I mean, it would if I did not have a wonderful staff. Having a staff who drives me from place to place. You know, New Jersey is not easy to get. Probably one of the things I'd like to do when I get to Congress is to help get fully funded some of the transportation bills that have gone through that are supposedly here to make transportation more accessible in these areas. But it's not happened yet. So that, going from place to place, I'm meeting thousands of people. I would say the main thing that I would say about blindness is that I'm very aware that many of the people I am meeting, probably thousands of the people I'm meeting, I'm probably the first blind person they've actually ever talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I'm very aware that when I am giving a talk, giving a campaign speech, or doing a campaign event in somebody's home or at some place, that I'm not only representing myself, but I'm also representing, in some ways, all blind people. And I think one of the things that was kind of a challenge and a responsibility is to help people come to some kind of, I'm sure all of us, everyone who's listening knows this very well, how to help people not feel so uptight about the language with being with a blind person. Like, God forbid they should say, "When did you see the movie?"
And
then they slap themselves around.
Right.
You know, how to help them know that I am comfortable with my blindness so that they can be comfortable with my blindness. And that's, you know, part of the challenge of the race, but it's been very, very successful, I think, so far.
One of the things that I frequently use to bring people through that barrier is humor, and often I will say to someone, "Now look, you really need to be comfortable about this, because if I were afraid to say the word blind, it could be awfully embarrassing if in a public to say the word see rather.
Right.
It could be awfully embarrassing if I were in a public place and I said to you in a loud voice, 'Well, I'll feel you later.'" And they do get the point. Hey, we have a call. Let's bring them in.
Okay.
Hi there. You're with Dennis and Marlena. Who's this?
Hi, Marlena. This is Shirley.
Hi, Shirley. How are you?
Okay. How are you this evening?
Good. How's Ohio?
Cold.
Oh.
Cold. We've got the fireplace going here tonight.
Oh, well, you and Lynn snuggle up to that fireplace.
Yeah, we will. You said the weather there wasn't too good.
Not too good today, but yesterday we had 80 degrees and we had a weenie roast. We had a weenie roast yesterday.
Unbelievable. Well, Dr. Shulman, I'm kind of curious. You know, you've been talking about how blindness would affect what you're doing right now, but I'm also curious about the fact, apparently, I believe in Marlena's information that she sent out, it said you were an associate rabbi.
Yes.
And I would imagine that that's certainly brought about, you know, some interesting reactions to people with your blindness. And I'm also wondering if at any point in time you're thinking at all about trying to you know, actually be the main rabbi at a synagogue any place, or, you know, if your interest right now is more just with the governmental issues or where you see your future going along those lines.
Yeah, as a rabbi, I have two major responsibilities. And one is that I do have a piece of a congregation. I have a piece of a pulpit. There are two other rabbis connected with this particular congregation. So my piece is that every Saturday morning I run the Sabbath morning service there. And that I've been doing now for 6 years. And it's a wonderful group. It's both a service and a study session. Just to give you an example, for the last probably 3 months, and this is kind of study I love. We've been studying the Book of Job one chapter at a time, one chapter a week, and there are 42 chapters in the Book of Job, so we're now up to chapter 15. But that's the kind of careful study that I like, and also, you know, it's part of the service. The other responsibilities I've had as a rabbi is that I've been a scholar in residence. I'm often called to do lectures at other congregations, and sometimes, you know, in Montgomery, Alabama, I did, and a number of other places in New York City. And I've also taught at the seminary, the Reformed Seminary in New York City. So I don't really have an aspiration to be the full-time congregational rabbi. At this point, I have the aspiration to be the full-time congressman from this district. And really to bring, I would say, part of the issue there is to bring some of the ethical values that we get from a Jewish-Christian background. Of course, being very aware of the separation of church and state, I would never advocate the non-separation of church and state, but that there are great ethical teachings of Judaism and Christianity in informing the way I think about political issues. Informing the way I think about the fact that, for example, just to go back to the same legislation I was talking about, that hate crime legislation is necessary in this country. Because whether one is disabled, or one is gay or lesbian, or one is black or Hispanic, we're talking about someone who is of value. Every individual is of value. They should never be a target of someone's hate, and that should certainly never be sanctioned by this government. I mean, that my ethics do figure in to the way I think about my congressional rabbi. But no, I do not have any real aspirations to be a full-time congregational rabbi. I kind of like where my rabbinic responsibilities are at this point, kind of being a scholar and also having a small kind of responsibility for a congregation.
Okay,
thank you,
I appreciate the information, and,
and
I wish
you
the best, in your endeavors there, and hope you make it.
Thank you. Thank you, Shirley. I appreciate that.
All right,
and
Shirley, do thank Lynn for me for putting me in touch with the LG person. We're having some dialogue, and so I appreciate that contact.
Okay, yes, I certainly will.
All right.
And we can, talk more about that.
You betcha.
I know the phone we have, for instance, does not provide the text messaging.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, great.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Have a good evening, both
Bye-bye.
Of you.
Bye. Yeah, what we're talking about, Dennis, is I chair the Information Access Committee for the American Council of the Blind, and the FCC has just promulgated its rule about allowing or requiring. Haven't seen the rule, so I'm not sure which word it should be, but equipped wireless providers.
Right.
To send out text messaging when there is a natural disaster or an emergency,
right,
a terrorist attack, et cetera.
Right.
So I have a great concern about blind folks who may have cell phones that are somewhat accessible but don't read
text
messages. So
of
that's
course.
Kind of what we're going
but,
on.
I mean, one of the issues, I know you heard me speak at the American Council of the Blind, one of the major issues, I think, for all of us is going to be how to make technology accessible, and I know there's been a huge amount of effort on the part of many, many groups from a wide variety. And, of course, that is going to be a major issue in the upcoming Congress of how to make technology accessible, especially, you know, in the issues that you're raising, Marlene. Of course, it's extraordinarily important that blind people, visually handicapped, won't be left out of the loop when we're talking about information about a natural disaster. Too many times. The estimates say that in the Katrina disaster, two-thirds of the people that did not evacuate were either disabled themselves or were relatives or were close relatives or taking care of someone who was disabled.
Wow.
Two-thirds of the people that did not evacuate. That is just frightening to think that there wasn't enough accessibility so that two-thirds of those people, you know, that disabled people were at a disadvantage in a natural disaster like that. So I totally applaud your effort to make information and access in a natural disaster equal opportunity.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, it's you know, some of the phones, it's not going to be a problem, but there are some that folks are using where it will be. Oh, I do want to get to your views on general issues, but I want to ask you a couple more disability-related questions. The telephone number is 866-666-7926. My guest tonight is Dennis Shulman, candidate for the 5th District, candidate for Congress from the 5th District of New Jersey. I'm so excited to have you on my show, Dennis. My tongue is all tripped over my teeth here tonight. We are finding that the FCC is less than, or has been, let me rephrase that, because we have finally gotten their attention, but has been less than responsive to the blind community, right from having equal representation on its consumer advisory committee down to responding to blind consumer complaints.
Right.
And I wonder what your thought is about that. How do we, you know, what is your thought about that?
Well, the first thought I have is that one of the sacred obligations any congressman or congresswoman has is oversight. And the FCC is a branch of the executive government, and Congress's job is to oversee that branch, that piece of the branch in this particular case, the FCC. There is no reason why the FCC has a history of being unresponsive under the Bush administration to many consumer complaints, not just people who are visually handicapped. But, of course, I mean, there's been a tremendous problem with the FCC. It is the congressional committees who should be on top of them and saying this is not okay. And I'm looking forward to being part of a group that would be able to say something in a very direct way about the fact that the FCC, that part of the requirement of the FCC, is, of course, is to serve all its constituents, and that, of course, includes those who have been left out of visual description technologies or text messaging technologies or the kinds of bandwidth that is involved in special access for people with communication disorders. I mean, all of that is extraordinarily important, and that should be a part of what a congressional committee is overseeing when they oversee the FCC. They should be pulling those people in and asking the questions and getting good answers.
Well, I certainly look forward to the day when that will happen. I'm actually aware of a particular congressman who sent an inquiry regarding some of this stuff, I think back in December, and finally just said, look, enough is enough. I mean, you're going to answer these questions, and you're going to answer them now.
Good.
And that's crazy. I mean, if they won't respond to Congress, you know.
Right.
So I'm very much looking forward to perhaps a new FCC that will do what it is supposed to be doing.
Correct.
Now, are you Are you at all concerned that people may sort of pigeonhole you, people in Congress may sort of pigeonhole you as, he's just saying that because he's disabled and he's going to be interested in this. How are you going to deal with that?
Of course, you know, as we all know, some people will dismiss another person based on he's just speaking because he's handicapped. But I really do believe that I'm going to be going to Congress not only to represent my district, but I'm going to also be representing because I'll be one of there are a few folks who are there who are physically handicapped or disabled in some other way, and I would be a person who would be going there in addition to my constituents here in this district to represent the community of disabled people. And I think that, that there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a fear somebody saying, oh, he's just saying that because he's handicapped or blind. I'm looking forward to saying, but, these are Americans too. And as a matter of fact, it's a growing number of Americans. Disability is a growing population in this country. And if on just a merely political level, never mind the moral level and the humanitarian level, a merely political level, every single elected official is going to have to deal with the issues that confront blind and otherwise disabled people, whether it be the Community Choice Act or the restoration of the ADA, further and more complete access to technology, or hate crime legislation, every one of the elected officials is going to have to go home and face a growing number of people who are going to be categorized as disabled. Not to mention the fact that the recent estimates have told us, tragically, that over 92,000 of our American soldiers are going to be coming home severely disabled.
Yes.
And
yes.
To turn and to not consider that part of the entire Congress's constituency and say, oh, this is pigeonholed, would be, adding another insult to the injury that people are facing. 92,000 people with severe amputations or other kinds of significant physical injuries, including blindness and including severe psychiatric illness. We're going to be faced with an increasing number of young people who are our heroes returning with disabilities. I'm sorry. If somebody says that I'm only saying it because I'm blind, I would be glad to answer them and debate them and say, you better look around, because if you're going to be if you're not going to be supportive of legislation for disabilities, then you're essentially turning your back on these people that went to this war and fought for this country.
Well, I tell you what, Dennis, I wish I were in your district, because I tell you, you've hit the nail on the head more eloquently, I think, than I've really heard it expressed by most people that I've asked this question concerning their public voice and disability. My husband, Gary, the board guy, happens to, I always say, don't ask how he spells board. he is a disabled veteran, and it took him, he is a wheelchair user, and make a very long story short, he injured himself in Vietnam. They thought they corrected it. He came home 3 months later, broke his neck from the injury that he got in Vietnam, and the VA denied his benefits for 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And then I married him, and they said, you're going to go back there because you're going to go to PVA, and you're going to tell them your story, and if they help you, then you've got a case. And, of course, they helped him. And now, after all these years, he receives disability from the VA. But he says to me, very often he says, you know, I feel like I live on the edge because it just takes a stroke of the pen in Congress
Correct.
To take these benefits away.
Terrible, terrible. And I'll tell you, one of the outrages, one of the many outrages I have against the person who is sitting in the congressional seat in this district is with all his rhetoric about supporting the troops, because he was a major, is and was a major enthusiast for this war in Iraq, which I am not. but with all his rhetoric about supporting the troops, he voted against medical benefits for returning disabled vets.
I do not
know how he sleeps at night. I do not know how he sleeps at night. But that's what he voted.
Boy, I'm not sure which is more shocking, that or the interstate dog fighting. Wow. Whoa. Okay.
Yeah.
If we've got anybody in the 5th District of New Jersey listening, perk up your ears, folks. This is who is representing you.
Well, I mean, we've had, I don't know if you're aware of it, but I know some of the ACB folks came to our event in Massachusetts when we recently had it. We have campaign events way beyond our district because many people see this not as a local congressional race, but because of who my opponent is, and I guess because of the interest in my candidacy as well, people are starting to see this as a national race. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with this, Marlene, from our literature, but because of that, General Wesley Clark has endorsed my campaign, and Steny Hoyer, the leader of the majority in Congress, is going to be coming into our district for an event. We've had a lot of national support, and that's because that when Scott Garrett falls, it will be meaningful to the entire nation because, in fact, it will say to the Republican Party, if you're going to put somebody up in the northeastern United States, put up somebody reasonable. Don't put up a far-right, what many people refer to him as Bush on steroids. Don't put up somebody who is so far-right. You put up a liberal Republican if you're going to be in the northeastern United States. So that there's been a lot of national attention on this race. So we've had campaign fundraisers in Chicago, in Boston, in Florida, a few in New York City. And anyone who's interested in getting involved in the race, we would love to have them. We're looking for buzz, we're looking for money, and we're looking for volunteers.
How do people do that? What should they
Shulman
do?
ShulmanForCongress.com.
And spell Shulman.
Shulmanfor, you know, for congress.com. As a matter of fact, we bought Schulman also, just so that they're referred to the right spelling. So shulmanforcongress.com, and we would love to have people support. We're looking for volunteers. For example, if you're good on computers, you can do that from anywhere in the world. If you have some money, we would love your money. we'll take it from anywhere. It doesn't have to be from, I mean, we can't take it from outside the United States. We can't take it from a non-U.S. Person. But basically, we will be glad to accept, you know, small contributions, large contributions. We will, all of that would be appreciated. And you can contribute using PayPal or, all of a sudden I'm blocking. ActBlue.
Oh, online. I don't even know about that one. Yeah.
Yeah, ActBlue is a website that is usually for every Democratic candidate. You can contribute through ActBlue, and we have links for that. And I made sure that those links are, you know, draws accessible. if people are interested, we would love to have your help. And, of course, we would love to have you spread the word to everybody you know, so that people know. The more people know about this race, the closer Garrett's defeat is.
I would like to ask your advice or input on something that I'm really bothered about. I'm absolutely not ashamed of telling folks that I am totally an Obama supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the emails from the Obama campaign, and I mm-hmm. volunteer to do things, and I gave some money and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very distressed that Obama, and I'm singling him out only because he's my guy, but he's not the only one doing this. Disability is rarely, if ever, mentioned in a public speech when disenfranchised populations are discussed. Mm-hmm. We hear about, as we should, we hear about Hispanics, we hear about single moms, we hear about folks who are black, we hear about, and we should, because many of those populations have a number of disenfranchised, numbers of disenfranchised mm-hmm. people within them, but we rarely, if ever, hear about disability. So mm-hmm. I keep writing to the Obama
Good.
Campaign,
Good.
Expressing that, but, you know, I sort of don't get a response, and that mm-hmm. upsets me. And I wonder if you felt the way I do, which I suspect you do, what would you do? No matter who the candidate is, how do you
right.
get their attention?
Oh, I mean, you get groups of people to, I mean, it's great to have individual letters, but it'd be better to have thousands of individual letters to make the point. Of course, those of us who are candidates for Congress and or in Congress who actually have disabilities, and there are a number of us, should be making that point to both Democratic candidates that this is an important population to be referred to be thought about, to be spoken about, that we can't be ignored. I mean, I think that it should happen on all levels. And anybody in your listening, who are listening to you, you know, there's nothing wrong with organizing a group of people. I mean, maybe doing it through ACB particularly, and having ACB organize a candidate lunch or something like that, where you actually bring them in and interview them and tell them what you think as a group. I mean, of course, groups are more effective than individuals because, of course, you know, the candidates are very preoccupied with 100,000 other things and 100,000 concerns. But you have to kind of make your, just like you would on the national scene or in the state scene, like you've done, Marlena, that you have to make your voice heard, and it's often the more voices, the better they will hear. So I would, you know, I would encourage you to organize that. Of course, as a candidate, just by the virtue of the fact of myself, my being blind, this is a discussion that I will be having with the whoever emerges from this race and becomes a Democratic candidate.
Well, I certainly appreciate that because it really just frustrates me, and I have felt this way for a long time, but haven't been as passionate about my candidate of choice as I am this year, and I'm pretty mm-hmm. passionate about Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The number to call, 866-666-7926. We'll have Dennis with us till the top of the hour, give or take, and then we'll be in open forum in the second hour. I'm Marlena, and my guest tonight, of course, is Dennis Shulman, candidate for the 5th District seat for Congress in New Jersey. Iraq. You're opposed to the war in Iraq.
I always have been.
What do we do about it? How do we get out of there, in your view?
Smartly. with intelligence, which is not how we got in.
Indeed.
We had to do what the Bush administration with Garrett, with Scott Garrett's tremendous enthusiasm, got into this war without by leading with military and not doing homework in terms of diplomacy. At this point, in terms of getting out of Iraq, look, we're in a Bush put us into a Rubik's Cube that's very difficult to solve.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, there is no wonderful solution, and I mean, I do not think it's a good solution to say we're going to pull everybody out immediately, because I think that will lead to a disaster. You know, nor do I think that we give them a blank check and say we're going to stay there for as long as somebody tells us we have to stay. I think we have to do a serious look at the policy, and it would have to include, for the first time in terms of this war, diplomacy, which means how do we bring in all the forces in the region and in Europe into this discussion of how to get out of this very difficult situation. Look, it's in everybody's best interest not to have an Iraq which declines into a massive civil war. It is in everybody's best interest, not just the people in Iraq, but the people in the entire region. And I think that's what's been failing, that we, you know, not only do we have to be strong as a country, we also have to be smart. And that's what we have not been doing. So I would say that we have to have a surge in diplomacy, a diplomatic surge at this point. Put all our efforts into diplomacy so that we can start withdrawing our troops soon and safely. And that's really the goal. I mean, I think that McCain's idea that we're going to be in there for 100 years is so, not only is it disturbing to me that somebody would say that, but it's also wrong. America is not going to tolerate much longer in this war.
Yeah.
And so that I think it's just a political reality that we have to start moving troops out. It seems to me very clear that Bush is doing at this point is trying to outlast the clock, you know, try to hand it over to the next president. And I think, unfortunately, he's going to be able to do that. And but we're going to have to, something's going to have to give very soon after the new president takes office.
I was very disturbed the other night when we were watching the news, and there was a piece, and I sort of came in on the middle of it, so my interpretation may be lacking something, but what I saw, I absolutely know. There was a piece dealing with a lieutenant in the U.S. Armed Forces and a captain in the Iraqi Armed Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And the lieutenant said to the captain, we got to go. We got to do this. You know, that we've got a sniper. We got to go. And the Iraqi captain didn't want to go. And he said, oh, I don't have enough people. And the lieutenant said, hello, you have as many people as I do. And then the captain actually said, but we have to eat lunch first. And so after they ate lunch, they joined with the American forces. And I was just outraged at here we are putting our citizens' lives on the line, and to see that attitude, I just found it outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, many people argue, of course, that it's because we've given the Iraqi government essentially a blank check and said we're going to stay until they tell us we can leave, et cetera, or until... I mean, the real problem is no exit strategy. Even the most recent reports by Petraeus, there's no exit strategy. You know, a number of people tried to press them, both Republicans and Democrats,
right.
Including
yeah.
Hillary and Barack.
Yeah.
Hillary and Barack tried to press him, the general, on it, and he just could not come up with the criteria for which when the troops can, in fact, start leaving at larger rates. There is no exit strategy. We went in without any thought. We went in without knowing the region. I mean, I'm talking about we. I mean, the administration went in without knowing the region. We went in, and one of the disastrous results of this war has been that we played right into Iran's hands.
Yes.
And now we have to pay the price.
Yes.
Our oil prices have bolstered their treasury, are taking their only predator in the region, Saddam Hussein, who I don't, and I'm not saying he's a great guy or a wonderful guy, but he kept Iran in check. We've taken him away. We've replaced it with a Shiite government, which, of course, aligns with Iran. For all kinds of reasons, again, I go back to, not only does America have to be strong, we have to be smart. And we were so stupid as a nation in what we did here. And I think that now we have to be smart, and it's going to take real thought. That's not something the Bush administration has great strength in, is how to be really smart in diplomacy.
Let's talk about the economy.
Yes.
Where are we going, in your opinion, and how do we fix it? What do we do?
Let's start with the fact that, again, the representative in my district is still denying that there's really a problem. And we're talking even, you know, there was actually a front page story in the Bergen County Record, the Bergen Record here, that basically said that foreclosures in this area are up by they're twice as high as they were a year ago in this area. And I'm sure it's much worse. I know it's much worse in other areas, in certain parts of California and Ohio and other places. What do? We have to address. See, I guess, you know, one of the things, getting back to one of the questions you asked me a little while ago, is one of the things that that kind of unifies my story as a psychologist, as a rabbi, and as a blind person, is that my whole life I've been thinking about and devoted my life to kind of how do I solve a problem?
Mm-hmm.
It's not been about ideology. It's about problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of us who are listening to this radio broadcast know very well that being blind means that there's a higher bar in how to solve problems. We are faced with problems that other people are not faced with. Often we're faced with it where we don't have families who are faced with it. You know, we're the only blind person we know in the area, or only blind person that, I mean, we're faced with problems. We have to learn how to solve problems. I feel like it's the same thing with the economy. We can't apply ideology. We have to apply problem solving. The guy I'm running against is an ideologue. I'm a problem solver, both in psychology and rabbi, and of course as a blind person. And I think that at this point, we have to address the systemic problems. We have to do something to curtail the foreclosures. We have to. We have to figure out ways to increase jobs. And I'm talking about long-term solutions. Within the blind community, it's frightening to think that, on the average, blind people are educated at a higher rate than non-blind people. And yet our unemployment rate is someplace above 70 to 80 to 90%.
Yeah,
that's just outrageous.
It is.
But it's all unemployment is high among the non-disabled as well. And I think the only way we can address the economic problems long-term is going to be increasing jobs in infrastructure, increasing jobs in education, you know, all access of education, making more access to education for blind people as well as others. I mean, there's all kinds of systemic issues. I'm aware of the clock, so I'm going to have to curtail my answer on
That's okay. You can, my show flows freely, so if we go past the top of the hour, that's fine with me, with you.
Right. Yeah. No, but it does seem to me like one of the worst problems that we've had in this administration, both, and here I'm applying this to global warming, as well as the economic problems that we have, that all of us who are speaking or listening knew we were heading into. Somehow, the administration was the last to figure it out.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, I saw George Bush be asked by a reporter watching on CNN one morning, well, Mr. President, what is your reaction to the fact that it is predicted that gasoline prices are going up to $4 a gallon? And he said, oh, it is? I hadn't heard that.
Right, of course.
That's just
and
nuts.
And I'll tell you, and when the Republicans maintain that they've cut taxes, gas prices are a tax. It is a tax. It's a tax on everything. It's a tax on food. It's a tax, of course, on community. It's a tax on heating a home. It's a tax on every single thing that we buy, our gas prices. So it seems to me like that is one thing. Any of you who are anywhere else in this country, when Republicans maintain about how they are into tax cuts, raise the question about, well, what are you doing in terms of cutting the subsidies for the oil companies then? Because that, in fact, has been applied in terms of gas prices increase and heating oil increase. That is a tax. It's just not called a tax, but it is as large a tax as increase that we've ever faced. And it seems to me like, you know, that's what one has to address, is that the Republican Party generally has been very cozy with the oil companies at a time when the oil companies are making more money in the history than any other companies in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, I recently heard, probably a couple, 3 months ago, I heard the Reverend Jesse Jackson make a very interesting comment about these, what do they call them, these tax subsidy checks that we're all going to be getting, everyone who files.
Oh, the stimulus checks.
Yeah, the stimulus checks. Yeah, and you know, I'm still kind of thinking about this, but Keith said, you know, they've gone about it the wrong way. If they took that money and put it into improving the infrastructure of this country so that people mm-hmm. could get improved transportation to get to jobs, give employers mm-hmm. the you know, some more capability to hire people, create an infrastructure that promotes a better way of life, the money would be much more well spent. Mm-hmm. But then on the other side of the coin, you know, you've got perhaps someone who is living on, you know, minimum wage, and, you know, they're going to see this money as a very valuable thing to them. Sure. What's your thought about the tax?
Well, one of the things that I was troubled by was that there were two groups of people that were excluded from the stimulus package, and that was people on Social Security
mm-hmm.
and disabled vets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That troubled me terribly. And I would say that the, you know, the stimulus package, if it's meant to stimulate, then of course it makes sense to do both kind of what Jesse's talking about, but also what the stimulus package is meant to do in a good way. The stimulus package is supposed to put money in the hands of people who really will value that money and then use it in there to pay for things that, in fact, will stimulate businesses in their local. There's nothing wrong with that kind of idea. But also, there should have been money for the local authorities to offset property taxes and to set up programs, particularly, you know, federally mandated programs in these areas, not only with disabilities but many others, to help build infrastructure, rebuild infrastructure. The fact that we're living in a country where all of us saw on TV a bridge fall down in Minnesota.
Yes.
In this country was again, an outrage. And so that we have to do something about infrastructure, rebuilding infrastructure in this country. We don't have the luxury to not do that. We have to rebuild New Orleans. We don't have the luxury to let a city just go. And we have to, of course, help the poorest of the people to have some ability to stimulate the economy. But why then leave Social Security recipients and disabled vets out of that package? That troubled me.
Yeah, absolutely. That troubled me as well.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis, before I let you go, I want to do two things. First of all, I want you to give your website again so that people can contact you. So why don't you go ahead and do that?
That's shulmanforcongress.com, shulmanforcongress.com.
And secondly, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you really want to speak out about?
You did a great job, Marlene. is there anything that I want to speak out about? There is one general issue that kind of is an overarching issue for my campaign. The major reason why I'm running for Congress beyond outrage is the feeling and the conviction that this nation, that we can do better, that we can do better. And it's not only that we can do better, but that our problems are solvable. I mean, anybody who's been through life for years and maybe has seen the civil rights movements in relation to the disability community or the African American community or the women's movement or the gay and lesbian and transsexual community, anybody who's been through the civil rights movements know that not only can we do better, but that in the face of daunting and what seem like intractable problems, people who love this country can change this country. And I'm hoping that all of us together will join together and change this country so that our problems can be solved. And basically, because my campaign is a campaign about replacing hopelessness with the conviction that we can solve the problems and we can do better. And I really do believe that. And I'm hoping that people will join me in this campaign.
Well, Dennis Shulman, I appreciate your spending time with us. This has been a joy. And with With from the bottom of my heart, I sincerely tell you it is an honor to call you my friend. I remember when we would stand in the circle at Carroll Rehab Center and sing the songs, and how we were just, you know, 17 years old, kind of just becoming in touch with ourselves and really learning about community, and what a joy it is for me personally to reconnect with you because of what it is that you're doing, and I appreciate you.
And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, Marlena, and also to all the people listening to your wonderful radio broadcast.
Thanks, Dennis, and we'll bring you back.
Okay, I look forward to it.
All right, thanks. You were listening in the last hour to Dennis Shulman, a candidate for Congress from the 5th District in New Jersey. I'm Marlena. I'll be right back. We'll have Open Forum coming up next.
Are you having difficulty reading the newspaper? Are you experiencing severe vision loss? Or do you know someone who is? If you answer yes to any of these questions, then the American Council of the Blind can help you. We are blind and visually impaired people from every walk of life who work together to enhance our lives. For more information or our membership application, call 800-424-8666 or contact us online at www.acb.org. The American Council of the Blind, forging new frontiers for our future.
Hi, this is Marlena. Have you been listening to ACB Radio for a while and wonder how you can help? Well, there's a Donate to ACB Radio link now available from the main page at www.acbradio.org. And thank you so much for listening to ACB Radio, where your listening is our business. Yes, indeed, your listening is our business. What a stimulating hour and 6 minutes we had with Dennis Shulman. I feel like I would like to have kept him on for the 2 hours, but it's difficult to talk, I think, for 2 hours pretty much straight. So I wanted to leave room to invite Dennis Shulman back again. Certainly one of the questions that we didn't quite get to is how are you going to manage, you know, in Congress as a blind person? What's your strategy? How are you going to keep up with things, and what technologies are you going to use and so forth? But I'm fairly confident that Dennis will come back and join us again here on the Marlena program. 866-666-7926. I'll be with you till the top of the hour, and then at the top of the hour, I get to go eat dinner with Gary the Board Guy. We traditionally have a steak and a half a baked potato and some vegetables and maybe some red wine. So I always look forward to that, but I won't start thinking about that until closer to the top of the hour, so you won't hear my stomach rumbling. Want to know what's on your mind tonight here in the open forum portion? I want to answer the phone. I was going to pose a question here, but we have a caller, so let's push the button and bring him on in. Hi there, you're with Marlena. Who's this?
I'm Marlena. It's Misty from Indiana.
Hey, Misty. I got your email. Did you get mine?
Yes, indeed I did, and I'm very happy to see that you're seeming to make efforts to get New York governor on.
Yes.
Whenever he was inaugurated, in fact, I was watching on CNN, and whenever he was introduced that day, I will admit quite openly that I literally stood in front of my television and applauded him.
Oh, that's great.
His accomplishment.
That's great. Well, hopefully you'll be able to applaud the same way Dennis next November.
Yes, certainly. Oh, indeed, that was a very, very stimulating conversation that you just had. Actually, I have a bit of a comment that's leading into a question, and perhaps you can give your thoughts on it as well as some of your other listeners.
Sure.
And that is, all too often, we see the various candidates, particularly those for president, speaking to, or I guess some might say pandering, but we'll use a more neutral term here, speaking to the interest of various minority communities, you touched on this earlier, indeed. You know, for instance, the various racial minorities, the GLBT community and such. But as you mentioned, you rarely hear these candidates speaking to the issues of the disability community, which, in my opinion and in the opinions of many others, represents just as legitimate a minority community as any of the others that exist. And I was just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on this particular problem and how you believe we might solve it and might make the general public understand that we too are seeking, as these other communities, for acceptance on a civil rights-based model.
Well, I tell you, it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone who knows me that I find it outrageous. I think that people with disabilities, and in our case, people who are blind or visually impaired, have literally been patted on the head and swept under the rug for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really happy that you're asking me this because it actually will lead me into one of the topics that I was going to bring up for this hour. So I'm really happy that you asked what to do about it. Well, you know, one of our greatest problems in the disability community, and particularly in the blind community, is we don't speak out. Now, there are a few who do. I mean, there are folks who do. But blind people notoriously don't complain.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a consultant for the National Park Service, and they would say to me, Marlena, we get complaints from the deaf, we get complaints from the wheelchair-using community. We've had 3 complaints over the years from blind people.
And I often wondered, indeed, why that is. I mean, I've experienced the same thing. I mean, I am a huge advocate, as you can probably tell, particularly within my local community, for representation of the visually impaired within the larger disability community. Because, I mean, I'm actually involved in an organization, a newly formed organization, at my university, which I have worked hard for a few years to get going. It was in existence a few years ago, probably 5 years ago now, but the people that were running it failed to, you know, kind of pass on the reins to the next generation. And there are a ton of wheelchair users, a ton of people with various learning disabilities and such, but the blindness representation is very small, as indeed it is on this 40,000 student campus. There are only about four or five other blind folks that I know here on campus. I've experienced the same thing with this passivity. I mean, so far I'm the only blind student to represent the rest of the community here. I mean, as small as it is, it's still, you know, strength comes in numbers, and it's still rather disappointing. But I found the same passivity, and it annoys me, I think, just about as much as indeed it does you, and I just wonder why this is.
Yeah, I don't know. I know, for example, that here, and I'm going to be very vague about this because I don't have permission from the folks involved to really discuss this, but I know of something that happened recently, which some folks wanted to change some conditions, and getting other people to sign on to a letter requesting change, getting other blind people to sign on, was a struggle. I mean, people just, they wanted the change, but they didn't want to put their name to the letter. And I guess that's a real frustration for me because I have yet to have someone who is blind explain to me so that I can understand and try to meet it head on. Mm-hmm. If you're dissatisfied with change, what is it that prevents you, or if you're dissatisfied with the situation, what is it that prevents you, what stops you from complaining?
Right. And yeah, I certainly can't understand that either. I mean, there are so many that will say, I think this is a big part of it as well. For some reason, many people are very hesitant to rock the boat. Oh, we don't want to offend, you know, and all of this. And we have to be nice to people and all of this. I mean, while there certainly is place for niceness, as it were, there's also a place for being assertive. And, you know, because, I mean, sometimes that's the only way that we're going to, we're going to get change.
Well, and complaining doesn't have to be nasty.
Right. You know? Yeah, there's a difference between assertiveness and aggressiveness.
That's right. The best complaint is a complaint that is factual and that contains suggestions for change.
I
think the word complain conjures up such a negative image that maybe folks who are a bit more timid are just not able to do that. But complaining is really getting your voice heard and suggesting an idea, suggesting a way to change. And I find it one of the frustrating things to deal with in systems advocacy, and certainly in individual advocacy. I have a friend here in Washington State, Sue Amater, who does advocacy both for ACB and for the Washington Council of the Blind. Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I admire about Sue is that, you know, she's been in the advocacy business for years and years and years, and she's still able to be very effective with individual advocacy, which sometimes means really just getting people off the dime and saying, look, you know, you got to write this letter and I'll help you do the letter. But, you know, and I don't know what it takes to bring people over that hurdle. But if you get any insight into it, I'd sure love to know.
All right, then. Well, perhaps some of your listeners can kind of add to that. Maybe they have some ideas, or maybe there are some out there that indeed are timid themselves, and maybe, you know, we can convince them to get out there and advocate for themselves and for others. I will. I've probably taken up enough of your time already, and I'm sure there are other people who want to get on here. And so I shall hopefully talk to you later. And I appreciated the very, as you said, stimulating and insightful discussion you had with your guest earlier.
Oh, it was great. I so much enjoyed having him on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, then. Well, I shall talk to you later, then.
All right. Well, good luck in school and keep in touch. And keep Indiana on the mark.
I shall do that.
All right, Misty. Take care.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
And the telephone number, once I push the button, there we go, is 866-666-7926. I'm Marlena. It's about 17 minutes past the hour as I look at my Braille note telling me the time. Of course, by the time you hear me say that, it'll be closer to 18 minutes or 19 minutes past the hour. The internet provides us such interesting time dilemmas. 866-666-7926. Phones are kind of quiet tonight. Folks are either out or just so entranced with what we're saying. But we've got a call now. We'll bring them in. Hi there, you with Marlena. Who's this?
Well, this is Stan.
Well, Stan the man from Oregon. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just fantastic. We've had just an extremely beautiful last couple of days.
Oh, you got today, too?
Yes, we had
didn't get today.
Well, we had 78 degrees today for a high. We had 84 yesterday.
Well, goodbye, Stan. It's time for me to let you go now. We had 80 yesterday and 56 today.
Whoa, that's a graphic change.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, we had a weenie roast last night.
Oh, man, we did. Yeah. We did some things yesterday, did some asparagus and some other good eats.
Oh, yum, 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 yum.
And got together with the family and had a terrific, terrific time.
Hey, have you made any good stuff in your pressure cooker? Any more good stuff? You always make good stuff.
No, I haven't done anything really good. Oh, I did. Let's say a while back I did a roast.
Oh, you like to tell me about that. You know, I'm still, I know I keep saying this, but I'm still working on the book for us. I just do it a little bit at a time.
What I did was I had subscribed to the Cooking in the Dark list.
Oh, yeah?
And what I did was I made it, got some mushroom soup and some onion soup mix and mixed those two together, put them in this roast, did a couple other little bit of seasonings. And some vegetables and.
So wait. So did you mix the mushroom soup and the dried onion soup together, and then did you put that in the pressure cooker first?
Yes.
Okay. I want details here.
And then put the roast in.
Okay.
And then.
And what size was the roast?
A little over 2 pounds.
Okay.
and about two and three quarter pounds to be precise.
All right.
Then I set it for about 45 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I'm having trouble figuring out my timer. I'll have to.
Okay.
Tell me about that.
There's, let's see here. I got to think. About the fourth button down.
Yeah.
The third button is where you set the pressure.
Right.
To one is low and second is high. You know,
right.
Two presses of it.
Yeah.
And then next to the pressure button, about the fourth button over, you know, they're in rows. So
yeah, see, mine's just in one row, but time is under pressure.
Right, and then you can set for each minute is a press of a button.
Oh, okay.
And then at the very last button is the, think of it as the time set button.
Okay, so if you want, but if you want something that's like, well, I guess you wouldn't want something that's 2 hours in a pressure cooker.
No.
Because that would be, I mean,
no,
you'd be pressing it all day.
It would turn to mush.
Yeah. Okay. So you put the soups together in the pressure cooker. Then you put the roast. Then you cut up
a little bit of, and then a little bit of, I'm doing this from memory, a little bit of, I think there's a little bit of sour cream. No, it's just the vegetables. And then the vegetables in it.
Okay.
The frozen ones.
Yeah.
And then you set it, and then there's the little valve thing that you set.
Yeah.
Put that over it, and then there's this little pressure, sort of like a valve that you push all the way
right,
to the end.
Right.
And once you set those two things, and you set the time, and it'll go beep, 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 beep at the end.
And how long did you cook it for? You didn't tell
45
me.
45 minutes.
45 minutes. Holy cow. Okay,
it's actually good. It's tender as the dickens.
So,
of course, you could brown it first if you want to.
Yeah. And our pressure cookers, since we have the same one, essentially, will allow us to brown in the pressure cooker even.
A bit of oil.
So, did you use, like, the frozen beef stew vegetables?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course. One bag or two?
Well, see, it's a pretty good sized bag, so.
Yeah, it's like a pound, yeah.
Yeah, so you could use, maybe half bit of whole bag, depending on.
Right. Now, you didn't call me up to talk about your pressure cooker, so now I'm going to let you talk about what you called me up to talk about.
Okay, and I'll talk to you at some other point in time off the air, and we'll go through how to set it, because it's real quick here.
Okay.
And then I'll be more than happy to guide you through it, because that's what we're here for, to work together.
That's right, and God knows I need all the guidance I can get, honey.
No. Don't pick on yourself.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that's, I think, a challenge, is that I was started out as sort of a friendly activist. When I was running for the Rogue Valley Transportation District Board.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to be a buffer between, because I think one of the things that has hurt the disability community, you have to do it to be an advocate, I think, without being too militant.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by militant is, my way or the highway. It's our need to come first with being a steamroller over the public. I hope I'm coming through. I hope you're able to understand where I'm coming from.
I think so. I think
it's
clear.
Because I think you have to do it because, I don't know why people are going to say this, but I always like the old saying, you catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar. Why we want to catch flies, I don't know.
I know.
But I think that's our worst problem is that sometimes people can be, and they think, there's a perception. And what I've tried to do in the community, and I've had even my people who started as being detractors, have talked about what kind of job I'm doing in good tone. So I'm very happy with that. But what I'm doing is saying, look, we have to have needs. But we have to do it, for example, if you're doing paratransit, you have to do it in a cost-saving manner.
Mm-hmm.
We can't say our needs are so paramount that they're at the expense of all others. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have to have a unified, cohesive team.
And we have to make requests or suggestions that are reasonable.
Well, that's what I mean. What I mean by the militancy part.
Yeah.
We have to be reasonable about the way we approach things and understand that we have to do something called compromising.
Yeah, but there are people, to play the devil's advocate here, there are people who say, you know what, Stan, I am sick of being reasonable. I am angry, and I've been reasonable all my life, and look where it's got me. So, by God, it's me first and my needs first, and that's what I'm going to do.
I understand that, but we are a small community, and what happens is that if we are to, and I understand that, and that's where you have a balancing act. You have to be balanced between, I understand what our needs are, because we all feel that way to a certain extent. But we have to be reasonable, because we have to remember that to get what we want, we're going to have to show a reasonableness to a certain extent so that others can be our biggest advocates, in other words, and to rally for our cause, in other words, to co-opt them, to make them say, oh, we understand what these people.
Sure.
And I think that's one of the key elements that I think we have to do that, because we can alienate others to such a degree that we make them unwilling to accept us.
Why do you think some blind folks, and it seems like many blind folks, why do you think blind folks don't complain? What do you think is behind that?
I think we are a microcosm of society. If you'll notice, many people in society figure that things are going to get better. We'd so all depend on the next guy to go out and go vote, all depend on the next guy to do this, to do that, or do the other thing. Because I think what happens is people don't, I mean, many times when you have meetings on various projects to discuss ways to deal with situations posing both the problem and possible solutions, you get people that oftentimes don't want to do it. So there are a few worker bees and no one else to help take up the slack.
Yeah, but even in the disability community, though, we are notably not present in terms of people who file complaints.
Oh, I know that.
I think
what the real problem is, we don't get out there and complain, because many of us feel, and I'm not one of them, but many of us feel that our complaints never do any good.
Yeah, I have heard that. Well, why complain? It
and I think that that's one of the big issues that we have to confront. We can thrash out issues, we can disagree with each other, but we need to disagree without becoming disagreeable.
I like that.
And I think that if we can do that and realize that, you know, that we can address issues and at the end of the day have a cup of coffee together or whatever beverage you choose and visit and say, hey, we may disagree about things, but at least we can come together and, you know, discuss the issues of the day. And I think that if we can do that and show, because there are times when I get tired of doing, even when I'm doing carrying the load and saying, what am I doing this for? When you're elected and you're not getting any, you know, pay for it, you're doing all the work. And the only thing you hear about is when people don't like something.
Yeah.
That part's the tough part.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the call, sir, and I also appreciate the recipe. That was kind of my own personal privilege there, but...
Hey, no problem, and I'll be more than happy to guide you through the instructions in terms of how to set things, because I've had plenty of time working on that.
Well, I've just used it once in and actually made the one thing you told me about, which is taking the frozen chicken, except I use pork chops and put them in the spaghetti sauce, and you know, oh gosh, they were so good. Oh my gosh, fork tender.
Yes.
Fork tender. All right, well,
great for steaming rice too, by the way.
Oh yeah? Oh well, we'll have to talk about that.
Okay, well, I'll be more than happy to help you through that too.
You're the best.
Thank you.
All right, Stan.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. 866-666-7926, and we're going to be right back. This week's Marlena program is brought to you by HumanWare. Visit them on the web at humanware.com or call them at 1-800-722-3393. HumanWare, empowering people through Braille literacy. Hi, this is Marlena. Have you been listening to ACB Radio for a while and wonder how you can help? Well, there's a Donate to ACB Radio link now available from the main page at www.acbradio.org. And thank you so much for listening to ACB Radio, where your listening is our business. Now, we thank Don Barrett for that great slogan. We had a contest a year ago, and Don was the winner of the contest to give us that slogan. Without you as listeners, we wouldn't be here. I'd be talking to myself, and happily I'm not, because I have a caller. Hi, you're with Marlena. Who's this?
Hi, Marlena. It's Steve Metzer from New York.
Steve Metzer, how are you?
I'm very well. Very well.
Great to hear you.
Yeah, well, I hear you every week, so I figured maybe it was your turn to hear me.
There you go. I like that.
You were discussing before about why blind people don't complain.
Yeah.
And that sort of hit a soft spot with me. I think one of the reasons that blind people don't complain is they're afraid that if they do, somebody's going to overhear them and say, oh yeah, you don't like the way things are? Well, we're going to take this away, and we're going to take that away, and then see how you like it.
You think?
I'm wondering if that's part of it.
Yeah.
You don't like how much money you're getting? Well, how'd you like it if you weren't getting any? You don't like your housing? Well, how'd you like to live in the street?
That's a very interesting perspective, Steve. How do we get around that? What do we...
Oh, there is the question.
Yeah.
I believe the way to get around that is by doing it in numbers, and that brings me to another complaint I have about the blindness community, is we're not nearly unified enough.
Now, tell me what that means for you.
Witness the fact that there's two blind organizations. How many deaf organizations are there? One. How many really big paraplegic organizations are there? Probably one. Why do deaf people have closed captioning and we lost SAP and DVS?
Well, yeah, exactly. But then on the other hand, you know, just as there are choices in political parties in the United States,
But that's a different kind of unification.
Well, I understand.
They will never be unified.
Yeah, I understand that. But until blind people, our leaders in our community, can come to the table and find middle grounds.
That's the problem.
And that is an issue. Because that's one of the reasons that we lost SAP. It's one of the reasons why sometimes legislators don't want to talk to blind people, because they say, look, you know, we just had these other folks here, and they were saying just the opposite of what you're saying. They don't know who to believe.
Precisely. That's a real problem.
But how do we bring the leaders to a moderate position where at least on major issues we can present one unified voice.
I wish if I had that answer, I'd be a very rich man.
You'd be a millionaire. I'd give you your first buck.
Okay. The buck starts here.
The buck starts here. Hey, you're doing the secret stash.
Oh, do I get a plug?
Yeah, of course you do.
Oh, rock and roll Monday mornings from 8 to 11. Now that it's daylight saving time.
Yeah.
That's 12 to noon to 3 Universal, and progressive rock Friday nights back in the home of the slot, man.
Yeah.
10 p.m. Friday nights. So the wee hours of the morning.
That is so cool that you've got that. That's the one you started with, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is so cool.
Glad to be back in the spot.
On ACB Radio Interactive.
Yeah, nice 128K stereo. We started out with 11.025.
Do you remember that? Oh, my
gosh.
Oh,
my goodness.
I still have recordings of some of my old shows that way. Oh, my gosh. Sort of sounds like we're in a paper bag. You know, one of the questions I forgot to ask Dennis, only half jokingly, was when you get to Congress, Dr. Shulman, what are you going to do about this daylight saving versus standard time issue? Let's just have one time.
That's true.
We don't work in the fields anymore. I don't know too many people who are out in the fields, you know? And that's why it all started, as I understand it.
Even if you do work in the fields, if you want to get up an hour earlier, knock yourself out.
I mean, it's just set your clock, you know?
That's all.
And it was funny because when Dennis and I first started talking about the show, we were in standard time. So I was telling him that, you know, we would be calling him just before 8 Eastern. And so just yesterday I sent an email. I said, okay, we'll call you just before 9 Eastern because I'd forgotten. We've been talking about this for a while. So he sends me this email back and he said, this psychologist rabbi has his eyes crossed trying to figure out, are you going to call me before 8 or are you going to call me before 9? So I had to then write him back and explain the difference. But
yes.
This time thing is maddening.
We do run on a universal clock, ACB Radio does.
Yes, we do. And so we do all the changing, and time marches on.
Yeah. Well, I guess I get to sing my famous song, See You in Kentucky.
Yay! Yay, Run for the Roses and all that good stuff.
Right.
Yes.
We'll be playing that a couple of weeks from now on the old Secret Stash.
Oh, I love that. I love that song.
This week it's going to be all about taxes.
Taxes?
Sure.
What kind of music do you have about taxes?
Only one, unfortunately.
Oh, darn. Well, you're just going to play it over and over again, right?
I don't think the copyright board would like that.
That's true. That's true. They would probably frown on that. Taxes, you know, that's another thing that's kind of a pain in the neck, isn't it?
I remember when I was in school, talking about, a good 40 years ago.
Yes, back in the Stone Age.
When I was back there in high school, I remember seeing in Braille, in four magazine-sized pamphlets, the 1960-some-odd version of the 1040 form.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, why don't they still do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't they even, like, prepare a BRF file for download or some sort of electronic thing that you could look at? I have no clue what's on a tax form these days.
Well,
all I know is how to answer the questions when my guy calls me up and asks me.
Yeah, yeah, that's the same for me. You know, and it's difficult to be prepared if you don't know. Yeah, I mean, you know,
what
generally.
To be prepared for?
Yeah, I mean, you know, generally what you have to have, but it's certainly if you can't look at the tax form, it's difficult to cross all those T's and dot all those I's when your guy does call you, so you've got it all together. But
right.
Yeah, but you know, I wish that we just had a graduated income tax and called it quits. That
would be quite handy.
I think this country spends more money collecting money from citizens who don't have it to give.
I wouldn't. Tell me about it.
Now I know the blind folks who work at the IRS are not going to like what I have to say, and I would worry about finding replacement positions for particularly people with disabilities. But
never mind them. What about the 30,000 others?
Well, if the IRS went away, I wouldn't lose any sleep, you know.
Well, I don't think I would either.
Yeah, yeah. But now that we've offended all the blind folks who work for the IRS, who else can we offend before I let you go?
Oh, I don't know. I'll think of somebody. Well, I don't talk to you often enough offline. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing you in Kentucky.
Well,
how many beers do I owe you?
You know, I think we're up to like 3 or something. But we'll keep going, you know, and then we'll have a whale of a time.
And pretty soon I'll owe you a whole case.
There you go. There you go.
I'll send you a case of some local microbrew from New York.
Ooh, well, you wouldn't have to send me a case, but well, I'm looking forward to seeing you too. We'll have a good time.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, well, you take care, sir.
Take care. See you soon.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 866-666-7926. Steve Matsura, who is one of the founding DJs, the original DJs on ACB Radio Interactive, on our music side of the house, and who works tirelessly along with my good friend Larry Turnbull from Florida convention to make the broadcasting of the ACB convention actually happen. Larry helps out a lot at the actual convention location in the ballroom, and Steve kind of knocks it all together in the exhibit area and makes sure that Interactive is on the air when the exhibit hall is open. So we've got some great folks involved in this effort called ACB Radio. And we've been around for a lot longer than some people thought we might be. And, you know, we have our ups and our downs, but it's a totally volunteer project. We have sort of 1.5 paid people, and all the rest are volunteer. People come to convention out of their own pocket. They use their own resources. They come, they put ACB Radio on the air so that you all can hear the convention, hear the exhibit area, and they do interviews with folks in the exhibit area so you can learn about the technology that folks are exhibiting, and nobody gets paid to do that. It's all done out of love for broadcast work, out of love for getting the word out, and certainly out of love for ACB Radio. It's about 42 minutes past the hour. The phone number is 866-666-7926. I was having a conversation Friday night. First, let me back up a little bit and tell you that we here in Seattle had the opportunity to see Blind Sight, the movie portraying Eric Weinmeier, who, of course, is the blind mountaineer, and Sabria Tenbruggen, who was on my program several weeks ago, the German woman who traveled from Germany on her own through China to Tibet to begin the first Tibetan school for the blind, which is now called Braille Without Borders. And they got together, Sabria and Eric. Eric visited the Braille Without Borders school and offered to do a trek up La Prairie, which is a mountain 21,000 feet, neighboring Mount Everest. And six of the children from Sabria's school, Eric, his climbing team, Sabria, and her partner in Braille Without Borders and in her life, Paul Cronenberg, did an expedition up to the summit. And I won't give away the end of the movie, but suffice it to say they did not make it to the summit. They came within 1,500 feet of the summit, which Sabria told us when she was on our program here. But I share all this with you to kind of share how this all happened, how we got to see this in Seattle. The theater at which it was going to be shown indicated quite strongly, oh yes, we have the equipment to play the video description, which is embedded into the film. And for those of you who have never experienced video description, what one does is you go to the movie theater, they give you some headphones, you sit down, the movie starts. When the movie begins, you and only you and others with headphones on can hear the narrative. Okay, and so if you don't have the right equipment, you don't hear the narrative. And we have a call, and I'm trying to get to the button here. Yikes, what is going on? Okay, let's push the right button first of all. Hi there, you're with Marlena. Can I ask you to hold just one second?
Okay,
we'll be right there with you. So the theater assured us that they had the equipment to play the video description, and so we sent out this invitation far and wide. And the next day they said, uh-oh, we don't really have it. We mean that we have equipment for deaf people. So I will finish the story after we hear from this caller. Hi, thanks for holding. This is Marlena. Who's this?
This is Karen from Illinois.
Hey, Karen, how are you?
Doing fine.
Good. What's going on with you?
Not too much.
Yeah?
Just doing some of the usual stuff tonight.
Yeah?
But I wanted to comment on your point of earlier this hour, second hour, on why disability is not addressed.
Yes.
I think part of the problem is that a lot of people in the disability community don't vote.
Yeah, that certainly could be a part of the problem. I agree with you. I agree with you. How do we motivate people to vote then?
I am not totally sure how we do that, but and I'm not even sure how we track that, but I think people have to be a lot less nervous about tracking, because the only way we're going to get the numbers is to track that.
And I'm not even sure that there is a system in place that allows us to track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I feel very strongly about, now that I have in my area, the accessible voting machine,
mm-hmm.
and even before that, even before the accessible voting machine, I hated to vote by absentee ballot because nobody saw me. You know, nobody saw a blind woman with a guide dog walking in to the voting booth.
Mm-hmm.
So I made myself, or I believe we make ourselves, even more invisible by choosing to vote absentee ballot. What do you think?
I agree with you there.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Although, certainly, Mr. Obama has on his website quite a well thought through paper on his disability issues platform. So to take the time,
interesting, because like a lot of the candidates don't usually address that specifically.
Yeah,
as you've so eloquently stated.
Yeah.
Republican or Democrat,
exactly.
For that matter.
Exactly. That's not a partisan issue. It's a fact.
Ew.
That, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think that we need to be, we need to begin to hold these candidates accountable. And, I'll keep writing to the Obama campaign until somebody answers me, with an explanation of why Barack, who I absolutely am voting for, I wear his badge, I mean, it's just, I'm very pleased that he's running and he's someone I can get behind. But it does really disappoint me that he doesn't talk about disability when he mentions disenfranchised minorities. So,
and that's the case, as I said, with all of them.
yeah.
Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. Well, we've all got a lot of work to do, I think, and I think...
I don't disagree with you there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir when I talk to you, because you and Ray are both such tireless advocates. But, you know, we've got to get our people off their butt and get them involved, get them, make sure they're registered to vote.
In fact, I'm involved with a task force here in Illinois that's working on creating a support service provider program for people who are deafblind. And the issue of voting has come up there, too.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Getting people registered to vote, because legislators check for that.
Yeah.
When you do advocacy work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you keep it up, and, you know, eventually...
I will.
I know you will. And, hey, I'm looking forward to seeing you in Louisville.
You got it.
All right, my dear. Give that nice husband of yours a big hug.
Will do.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
866-666-7926. So, the theater told me that they did not have the... They made a mistake. You know, we have it for deaf people. We don't have it for blind people. Now, I have two choices at that point. Give up, rescind the invitation, or hold their feet to the fire a little bit with firmness and kindness. And so I chose the latter, and I pretty much said, look, I got a problem here. You know, we've got two or three groups of people. This movie is very, very important among the blind community. It's important on a lot of levels for people to see this. And based on what you told me, we've, you know, gone and organized, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they said, you know, we don't know. So I said, look, there's got to be a way to solve this. And I had the audio of the movie, which was sent to me by the movie producers. So I had the opportunity to listen to the movie. Actually, I have the video too, but I can't figure out how to play CDs from iTunes, which is what I had to do. So I just took the audio and listened to it on my... on my stream or my icon, I'm not sure which, and knew that this was a movie that we just had to see. And so I said, look, you know, what can we do here? The people who distribute the movie, perhaps we could work something out with them. Your chain of theaters, and I won't say which chain, but your chain of theaters is noted as a chain that provides the video descriptions. So how about if we contact some of the other theaters in the Seattle area in your chain and see if there's any way we can resolve this. And so I, you know, pretty much indicated to them, without ever getting angry with them, that no was not an appropriate answer, and that they had kind of helped get us in this pickle to start with. So it would be great if they could make an attempt to get us out of the pickle. Well, next day, got a phone call saying that, in fact, on the morning that the film would open, the video description equipment would be installed in the theater in which the movie would be shown. That is, you know, it's a small victory, of course. It's not life-changing. It's not anything that is earth-shaking. I don't even know if they're keeping it, if they've rented it. I don't know. But, you know, you take your little victories where you can get them. So in the process of all of this, the Washington Council of the Blind had a table set up in the lobby with the theater's full blessing and agreement. We had a table set up. I had Sabria's book in Braille so that people could see what a Braille book looked like. We had my Braille writer there and wrote people's names on cards for them. We had a slate and stylus there to demonstrate that. We had the WCB, of course, our brochures and so on. And Braille alphabet cards with WCB's information on them. So we gave a number of those things away, but what was great was that we sort of educated some folks, and they interacted with blind people. Oh, my gosh, can you imagine that? But in the process, after the movie, as I was packing up the table, got into a conversation with someone who was at the table who was very dissatisfied with the services that they were receiving from our services for the blind. And they said that, you know, they were looking for a job and they weren't getting any help. And so I said, well, what do you want to do? And the answer was, well, I don't care. And I said, you know, that's not an answer. What do you want to do? Well, something part-time, but I don't want to do customer service. And that was sort of repeated and repeated. And I said, okay, I hear clearly what you don't want to do. What do you want to do? And I tell you this story to ask the question, now that we have just 2 or 3 minutes left, and maybe we can talk about this next week, actually. But I tell you this story to ask you this question. Our unemployment figures among the blind community are so high, they're outrageous. But how much responsibility do we as blind people bear in that figure? You know, nobody gets a job by not knowing what they want to do. Knowing what you don't want to do is great, but you've got to have some idea of direction. And it occurred to me, I've been thinking about this conversation all weekend, and you know, it just occurred to me that somehow our system of rehabilitation, of education, our whole social structure may be our worst enemy here, in that we're not accountable to get a job. You know, if we don't get a job, we can live on subsistence money that comes to us monthly, and often give up. And I wonder what would happen if we had people like Dennis Shulman in Congress who could really begin to change the infrastructure to make it feasible then to say to blind people, look, you know, you can spend 5 years after you get out of school on this disability income, and then you have to start showing me where you've applied for jobs and what you've done to get a job. Wonder what would happen. Wonder what would happen. Think about that, and we'll talk about it next week in the open forum version of the Marlena program. Next week on the show, Kirk Adams is my guest from the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind. He's the first blind executive director there at the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind. And I'm looking forward to having Kirk on the show, and maybe we'll raise this subject with Kirk as well. We're going to have a little hiatus for a while. I've got some travel back to D.C. and some other travel. But when we come back, probably toward the later part of May, we're going to start our convention highlight programs. Get your blood going. Get you ready to come to Louisville. And by golly, we're going to have a whale of a time in Louisville. So until I talk to you next, have a great week. As always, it's been a joy to have you with me. Thank you so much for sharing a part of your Sunday night with me. I'm Marlena. Be safe. And I'll talk to you next week with my guest, Kirk Adams, Director, Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind.